Hi, everyone, and welcome to Remaking Tomorrow, a series of conversations about the future of teaching and learning. I'm Greg Baer, the co-author of When You Wonder, You're Learning, Mr. Rogers' Enduring Lessons for Raising Creative, Curious, Caring Kids. This is a podcast powered by Remake Learning, a network that ignites engaging, relevant, and equitable learning in support of young people navigating rapid social and technological change. On today's episode, I'm talking with Anne Brown, President and CEO of the Cook Center for Human Connection. The Cook Center is a Utah-based nonprofit that advocates for mental health and wellness. A note to our listeners. In this episode, we'll be discussing mental health challenges, including death by suicide, and the Cook Center's efforts to prevent suicide, expand access to mental health supports, and enhance human connections. Anne, welcome to Remaking Tomorrow.
Thank you, Greg. I'm so excited to be here and get to talk with you today.
We're incredibly honored to have you here, and this is such an important conversation in so many ways, and we'll dig into that. I suspect for a lot of listeners of this podcast, this might be the first time that they're hearing about the Cook Center. So let's start at the very beginning of the Cook Center for Human Connection story. The center's founders, Greg and Julie Cook, were presented with an opportunity to become early supporters of a new primary children's medical center in Utah. Can you take it from there?
I can, absolutely. Thank you. So when Greg and Julie were presented with the opportunity to give, they were actually the first donors to the Primary Children's Medical Center Lehigh campus. And when they were given that opportunity, they were making a large seven-figure donation. And they were given a chart that said, where would you like your donation directed? And it had things like pediatric cancer and the OR and the ER. And on that chart, it was a pie chart, and there was a little teeny tiny sliver. And they said, well, what's that? And they said, that's behavioral health. That's the hardest place to get funding. And so that's how they directed their funding towards behavioral health. But part of that story was also the fact that early in their marriage, a young boy who lived in their neighborhood was 11 years old and died by suicide. And when that boy passed, his father happened to be out of town. And so the mother called on Greg to be with her during this extremely difficult transition. And he was the one who notified the father. And as a couple, Greg and Julie just felt that behavioral health was called to them as the place that they wanted to give back. They never wanted another family to go through what their neighbor's family had been through. And then felt like they could even do more. And they started the Cook Center for Human Connection. I was hired as the first employee. And it was interesting what Greg said to me in the first months is he said, look, I've given to science through the hospital. I've given to the government through the governor's office. He says, those things are going to take years to see impact. I want to do something. I want to know that something's happening and that we're getting resources in the hands of families now and not waiting. And so that was kind of my calling card as we started the Cook Center is what could we do immediately to start helping families and children around the country?
I'm sure that any listener is like me and their heartstrings are pulling in 100 different directions. My mind wants to go in 10 different places. I want to go back to something that you mentioned in describing the remarkable generosity and insight of Greg and Julie Cook, and that is that the hospital leaders were struggling to find money to support youth mental health services. Can you say a little bit more about why that was and how much of that is still the case for medical providers and others around this country?
Well, I'll take the second part of the question first. I think it's still a problem. I think we are reducing stigma in a certain way, but it's still a struggle. Just going back to our origin story. At the time, suicide was the leading cause of death for young people in the state. In the rest of the country, suicide is the second leading cause of death behind accidents. But over about a five-year period, suicide became so prevalent in the state of Utah that it was the first leading cause of death for people from 10 to 24 years old. When they were given the opportunity to give to the Children's Hospital, that was 2018. So this is before the pandemic. And it was before we were shining such a light on mental health. And mental health had a huge stigma. When I started in this position in early 2020, before the pandemic, I told people that I was going into this work and I would see them physically flinch. It was just so difficult to talk about it. Since that time, I do think as a nation, we've recognized that mental health is a large issue and that everyone in the either themselves or someone near to them is struggling in some way. And the acceptance and the stigma has definitely reduced, which is allowing us to provide supports and services in a more acceptable way.
At Remaking Tomorrow, we take daily inspiration from Fred Rogers, Mr. Rogers, and borrowing from his mentor, a remarkable psychologist named Dr. Margaret McFarland. Fred would often say that, quote, anything human is mentionable, and anything mentionable is more manageable. Experiencing mental health challenges is part of our human condition, and it affects all of us at some point in the lives of our loved ones and the people around us. As you described, these are challenging topics to discuss openly with others, let alone with ourselves. And so what advice can you offer to our listeners to make experiencing mental health struggles, quote, a bit more mentionable so that they're a bit more manageable?
I think first and foremost is know that everyone is struggling in some way. Every person. I discovered this as I began this work. And when people knew that I was an open ear and an accepting ear, I started hearing their stories. And over the time of these 4 years, I now hear people tell each other their stories. It's not just to me. It's not just to someone who could be seen as maybe a secret keeper. People are open and willing to talk. And so there's nothing to be ashamed of with asking for help, with needing help, with having a child who might be struggling, with struggling yourself. And I would say of one of the positives that came out of the pandemic is this reduction of stigma around these things, this recognition that mental health is just health. And if someone in your neighborhood broke their leg, you would go to them and bring them soup. If you find out that someone is having a hard day or feeling depressed, it's okay to go and give them soup or whatever that care might be. Just think of mental health as any kind of health. It doesn't start or stop at our shoulders. You know, health is head to toe, and our bodies change and grow and have needs no matter where it is in our body.
And at the Cook Center, you're doing so much remarkable work to support that head-to-toe well-being that all of us needs. And you're doing it in schools and in communities across America. So can you give us an example or two of center-funded mental health initiatives that is giving you remarkable hope right now?
When we started, there were two really important pieces of research that spoke to us. One of them, probably the most impactful one, for us was that 80% of families rely first on their schools for their child's mental health. And when we read it, it makes total sense, right? Because where are children every day? And where do parents trust that good things are happening for their children? It's all about schools. So children are in school every day. They are with a teacher every day who is a professional about children, can see the nuances and the changes and the difference and the comparison and all of those things. It's reported that we are 3 million mental health workers short in the country. And in schools specifically, it's reported that we are 100,000 mental health workers short.
And I just, if I may interject, right, like that is an astounding number to me. 80% of families rely on schools as the front line for mental health supports.
Yes.
At a time when so many might be saying, oh, our schools shouldn't be attending to the social and emotional development of our kids. Well, in fact, that's where parents are turning. For better or worse, our schools are bearing the burden of addressing mental health supports as frontline staff.
Yes, they absolutely are. Parents and teachers. They're the ones who are with children every day, with the children every day, each individual child. We knew if we were going to affect youth mental health, we really wanted to do it in the school setting because of that fact, starting with that fact. And then the next part of that equation was really the parents, right? If you think about knowing that as a parent, when my child had need and I was desperate for help, I was 3 to 6 months away from being able to find that help. And at the same time, as a parent, you're worried about knowing what to do, saying the right thing, making something worse. There's all of this education that you just don't have in your lexicon, nor do you have people around you that have it. Most people, when they're dealing with parenting needs or issues, they have a support system around them. They have the other moms in their network. They have siblings that maybe have similarly aged children. You know, maybe they have parents that they rely on. But even this generation that we're dealing with right now are dealing with things on a level that only this generation of parents have dealt with. The parents who are, you know, 30 to 45 right now. So those normal networks, they don't have help and support. So all of those things together, Greg, this is a long way around to say what we decided to do is that we were going to support the parents with the idea that by supporting schools, helping them support the parents, that's going to help the parents be able to support the children, which feels like a long way around. But if you think about it, instead of one school psychologist for every 500 to 7,000 children, depending on the state that you're in, you can have every child have one-to-one support through educating their parents. And when I say parent, I don't mean mom and dad. I mean, who is in charge of that child's care? Who loves that child until they're 18? So I'm using a broad swath with the word parent. If we can educate and empower those people instead of a child being 1 to 7,000 for a school psychologist or 1 to 1,500 for a school counselor, they can have one-to-one support. They can have somebody who knows what to say and how to say it and what boundaries to put in and, you know, how to support their child through different aspects. And that person loves and cares for that child the most. By providing these resources and supports through schools to parents, we also reduce some of the pressures off of the systems that are in place in schools. So if a family can help their child through some anxiety, if they can help them through some depression, if they know what to say and how to help their child be more confident, some of the things that maybe a school psychologist would deal with could be supported at home, then we're taking pressures off so that the people who have the more severe need can get to their services and supports that they're looking for.
And so, Anne, as you're supporting schools so that they're better positioned to support parents because of the central role parents play and how the parents want to be, and in fact are positioned to be, that initial frontline staff, what does that support look like? Is it webinars? Is it training? Is it publications? If I'm a parent listening to this pod, like, what does it look like? And honestly, how can I find out more about it myself?
Yeah, absolutely. So parentguidance.org is the starting point. It's a no-cost site for a school or for a parent. Anyone anywhere can access it. We do it through the schools so that parents know it's a trusted source. But parentguidance.org is a collection of video-based courses all done by licensed therapists, psychologists, psychiatrists in 5 languages right now. Eventually, we'll be up to over 100 languages, but right now we have 5. In these video-based courses, it's things like helping your child be more confident, understanding anxiety in your child, even difficult things like why children self-harm or what parents need to know about suicide prevention, or typical parenting things like understanding your child's emotional development at certain ages. Also has courses on self-help for the parents, you know, meditation, rewriting self-beliefs, things like that. That's our first step, is anyone can access those. We also have a section of it called Ask a Therapist, where families can go on and they can actually create a question and our therapists give back video-based answers. It's anonymous. You don't have to sign up for it. You don't have to give an email address or anything. We just make that available nationwide, and that's through the Cook Center. We're working with about 7,000 schools across the country, not districts, but schools, but that equates to about 7 million families that now have access to this service through their schools.
This is Greg Baer. I'm talking with Anne Brown, President and CEO of the Cook Center for Human Connections. I'm wondering what else you're noticing in the world and what you're noticing suggests about where you might take the Cook Center's work next.
The first thing I'm noticing in the world is we were kind of at the front line of this idea of supporting parents, but others are coming along. Our U.S. Surgeon General released a report. It's a 40-page report called Parents Under Pressure, and it's talking about the impact of parental mental health on children and how parents can take action and deepen that relationships between themselves and their children. You know, they're recognizing the fact that parents are a key supporter to their children, but parents also need support. It's reinforcing to us that we're on the right track. School districts, when we started working with school districts with parentguidance.org, they came back to us and they said, could you provide seminars for our students? And so schools can access 16 facilitated topics a month, so that if people want to have a live group interaction, they can log on and be part of this live discussion. And then we had another, I remember this call so distinctly, I had a superintendent from South Dakota call me and say, we cannot find any mental health professionals up where I am. Could your clinical director come in and be our therapist in our district? And because of state lines and things like that, that doesn't work. But what we were able to create is a national coaching program. So school districts around the country contract with us, then any parent in their entire district can get up to 30 minutes a week of coaching, and we can get them a coach within 24 to 48 hours. And that coach works with the family on whatever they're dealing with, gives them suggestions, helps them set goals, helps them do the changes they need to make to have a healthier relationship. And some families will stay in for a few weeks, and some families will stay in for a few months. It's been a really positive experience to be able to provide families this help and this hope so quickly.
And in telling us about the beginnings of the Cook Center, you shared with us the tragic story that the Cooks themselves experienced, the suicide of an 11-year-old neighbor. And that prompts me to want to turn to some really important work that you've done around suicide prevention. There's an animated series that you've helped to create together with Wonder Media. It's a series called My Life is Worth Living. It's a series about suicide prevention that centers the stories of teen characters who have had thoughts of suicide and who learn that it's okay to need and ask for help. Can you tell us a bit more about that program and about its impact?
Greg, thank you so much for asking about My Life is Worth Living. This is some work that we are extremely, extremely proud of. In 2020, I knew a gentleman named Terry Thorin, who was the CEO of Wonder Media, and Terry was also the CEO of some much-loved animations that many of you have probably heard of, The Rugrats, Wild Thornberries, As Told by Ginger. His team actually did the first 68 episodes of The Simpsons. So he was animation royalty in this country, but he had stepped away from his role with Nickelodeon, and he really wanted to use animation for good, and he had this idea about how could we use animation to affect children's mental health. I had known Terry for a number of years. I had recently started with the Cook Center. I took this idea to the Cook family, and they said, absolutely, let's run with it. So the Cook Center was the funder. Terry was the animation and writer. But then we needed clinical support. So we gathered an extremely strong clinical team led by Dr. James Mazza from the University of Washington, who's one of the leading suicidologists in the country. We also used Dr. Kevin Skinner, who is the clinical director for parentguidance.org. We have a child psychiatrist on the team named Dr. Melissa Lopez Larson, and we have a pediatric epidemiologist on the team named Dr. Russ Osgithorpe. Our clinical team, every script, every animation pane, every sound, everything went through our clinical team. But our animation team did what they did best, which is tell an engaging story that is full of hope. My Life is Worth Living is the story of seven different children, and they all kind of live in the same universe, but they all struggle with the things that might make children consider taking their life. One of the things that's so alarming about children and suicide is that they are very impulsive. When something happens, they may consider taking their life and act on that within 24 to 48 hours. Children feel very hopeless when they're faced with a situation. They feel like they're the first ones in the history of the universe to have ever faced whatever it is they're facing. They don't know where to turn. They don't know who to ask. And so they can make a very rash decision very quickly. That's different than adults. Adults will take often a year. They'll plan and they'll get their affairs in order. And all of these things will be happening with an end date. And so knowing that, we wanted to tell stories that would show children being in that desperate situation, but showing them another path towards hope and healing. And through these just beautiful stories, we're able to show that you can get into a situation that you're maybe not where you thought you would be, but there are people around you that want to help. There's always someone who loves you. We talk about the helpers in each of these stories, and our helpers are trusted teachers, coaches, your best friend's mom. It can be a brother. It can be a therapist. all of these people combined to show that sometimes kids need to look outside of where they think they might look for help. And they might need to look a little bit outside of that, but there's always someone to help. So my life is worth living. No one ever gets hurt. No one ever dies. There's nothing scary in it. We always leave the characters at a place of hope and healing, but it takes you on the journey with them. And our hope is that parents and children actually will watch this together and be able to open conversations. So it's available at no cost on YouTube. It's on TikTok. Also at www.mylifeisworthliving.org, there's lesson plans that are available at no cost for teachers. And in every one of our lessons, there's a family engagement component. So if families want to watch and talk about this at home.
Anne, you mentioned the word helper, and hearing you use that word makes me think of Fred Rogers, because it's become sadly too typical in our American popular culture that when there's a moment of tragedy or disaster, someone will post to social media or a newscaster will say, look for the helpers, referring to Mr. Rogers' admonition to look for the helpers. But what we forget is the second part of that quotation, because you'll then know that there's hope. You've described it so well. I can't help but ask you, Anne, your work is heavy. How do you take care of yourself?
That's a great question. It is heavy. I have been married for 34 years, and I have an amazing partner in this work. We have a child who has need. He's 28. We have him, and I have a daughter who's 31, who's actually in this work with us. And I think how I take care of myself is surrounding myself with helpers, right? My husband and I have talked about how there's a day when one of us might be frustrated and the other one picks the other one up. And that happens pretty regularly in our life. And if we're both frustrated, our daughter picks us up. And our son definitely brings us a lot of joy. And also being a helper, I think this is the most important part, Greg. When you're in a difficult situation and there's a lot of emotion going on, whose emotion can be the highest? It's the helper. There's actually scientific research that if you are the person giving help, your brain is creating dopamine. You are feeling happier when you can be that helper. And I think that's a big part of how my entire team stays happy and joyful, is that we know that what we do every day is providing help. I have a full-time team of about 35 people that work on this with me. And we work in a joyful place, even though this is a heavy topic. And I think it is around this whole concept of helping.
And before we go, just one more question, please. What's one thing that parents and educators can do today to make tomorrow a more promising place for every young person?
The thing that I think is most important is when we go back to this idea of acceptable stigma, when you hear that someone has needs, first and foremost, don't be shocked by it, because probably everyone around you has needs, and it takes bravery to have expressed that need to you in some way. And then secondly, think about how you can help. And help can come in a lot of ways. It can come in just a listening ear. It can come in touch. It can come in just reaching out and saying that you understand. And if you're listening to this today, you've heard about parentguidance.org. Parentguidance.org is, again, no cost to anyone and has these resources available. So keep that in your lexicon of helping resources so that if someone comes to you and says, wow, I'm dealing with something at home that I didn't know I was going to be dealing with, you could say, there might be a course for you on parentguidance.org. Please go and access that resource.
Many thanks to Anne Brown, a remarkable helper and president and CEO of the Cook Center for Human Connection. Remaking Tomorrow is powered by Remake Learning. Learn more at remakelearning.org.